Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron, aka the Cricket Connoisseur, and on my left, as always, is my Lancashire co-host, Joe Nutsy Nuttall. So, Joe, mate, how's your day been so far?
Not too bad, thanks. I've just been, this morning, not just been, it's quite a while ago now, watching the end of the Australia game. Maxi dominated in that again, which was, he's not dominated yet in the series, but yeah, it was good to see him nail the ball around the ground, and then Ashton Agar did bowled a pretty incredible spell, didn't he? So, because what is it, 6 for 30. There you go, 6 for 30. Pretty mad game. So the series is it's pretty finely poised, and we'll see who comes out on top.
It is indeed, and I wonder where Ashton learned those spin bowling skills. Potentially in Midlands County, which he played for in 2019.
I'd suggest more in Australia when he's growing up, but.
No, he learnt it from playing with G-Tam. 2019, him and Greeny. That's where I reckon Ashton did. But yeah, he's been in excellent form ever since 2019, really. And of course, Glenn Maxwell broke a chair, didn't he, at the Sky Stadium in Wellington.
He did.
Which was quite funny. But no, Joe, I'm glad to hear that you're doing well, mate, of course. Always nice to hear that. And of course, today here on the County Cricket Podcast, we do also have a very, very special guest joining us. So it's my absolute pleasure to introduce you to today's guest, former Somerset, Northants and Derbyshire seamer, turned fast bowling coach, Stefan Jones. So, Stefan, first things first, mate, thank you very much for joining us here on the County Cricket Podcast today. How's your day been so far, mate?
Yeah, it's a pleasure being here. Good. It's busy at school, getting ready for every child to come back next Monday. Lots of COVID testing twice a week. So, it's a busy time. It's a good place to be at the minute at Wellington School. Lots of things happening, momentum, like most things in life, really. COVID has given us a reset. It's good. It's a good place to be, and it's okay being Stefan Jones at the minute.
Well, that's excellent to hear. That really is good to hear, Stefan. And of course, we'll talk about your journey with Wellington as the podcast progresses. Yeah. But before we get into the world of coaching, because that will be a major part of today's podcast, we of course have to talk about county cricket here on the County Cricket Podcast. So let's transport you all the way back to your earliest cricketing days then, Stefan. What's your first ever memory of cricket, either playing or watching the game?
Well, I haven't done anything normal in my life, really. So I started late to cricket and rugby. So being Welsh, it was you played seasons. So you played rugby in the winter and cricket in the summer. But I didn't start playing until I was about 13, 14, because I went to watch my dad. So I watched my dad playing. He played a decent level. And I watched him coach. So I was in the changing rooms with those fruity language when I was young. And my dad used to tell me, don't tell your mum and all that. But then I learned so much from it by not playing as such, because I think kids get pushed into playing too young. So I watched, and then I just trained on my own, went down the field, kicked the ball, bowled the ball, put the stumps down, aimed the stumps, and was there all Sunday afternoon. I just free play. And then one day someone said, you should be playing. So I did. And then my first cricket game, I got 7 for 14. And then my mum and dad thought, oh, hang on, you could be all right. But no, forced. I wasn't forced to do anything. Then played lots of club. We didn't do cricket at school. It was all rugby. It was next to the Scarlets. And then I was a international schoolboy rugby player. So played Wales, 18s, youth, 20s, 21s, universities. And then I went to Loughborough University, Cambridge University, got my blues, then became professional rugby and cricketer. So the last person to do both. I was Exeter Chiefs' first ever professional rugby player, full professional. Then I retired from rugby 98, I think, and then played cricket ever since. But it was very much on, I had no desire, probably desire is not the right word, but I didn't plan on being a professional sportsman. I was going to be a PE teacher. I don't know why, you know, my PE teacher inspired me, I think, when I was younger. And I liked the thought of inspiring and sort of having that impact on a child's life, because he had a huge impact on mine. I went to Loughborough, and then I was okay at it, you know. I was a pretty handy rugby player. I didn't like tackling because I thought I'd hurt my shoulder when I for cricket, but I could do things in the rugby field. No, I don't see a lot doing that now. I was talented at rugby, and then I became a manufactured cricketer, I would say. But I did go through stages of being one of the best around, and then others not so good. So, but I had this ability to play rugby and cricket, not much else. And I've had a good journey really, and I enjoyed it. And I came out on my own time, and it's got me where I am now.
I mean, it's an incredibly unique journey into the game of cricket.
It really is. Yeah, it definitely is.
100%. Like, we spoke to John Simpson. He was one of our previous guests, and he mentioned about his family influence. He was playing cricket when he was about 18 months old. And yeah, you're there in your teenage years. I mean, you're playing rugby as well. And I did just have a question, because the rugby thing has just sparked this in my mind. Stefan, what's your thoughts on the all sports principle? Because I've heard players like Jonty Rhodes, Kevin Peterson, AB de Villiers, for example, these guys used to play hockey and tennis. So first of all, do you think that there are any transferable skills between rugby and cricket itself? And second of all, are you one of these people who's in favour of young cricketers playing these multi-sports and gaining these different skill sets? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you have to. You can't specialise. You shouldn't be specialising before the age of 18. You have to do, and it's not about transferring skill. It's about transferring athletic skills, so movement, hand-eye coordination, robustness, resilience, speed, agility, all stability, all that stuff that you don't get if you just do one sport. And that's a big thing for me, and I know you're going to ask me in a minute about fast bowlers, mm-hmm. why there's not a massive amount of them, and people can say there is, but there isn't. You know, the West Indies bowlers in the 70s, the West Indies C team could probably be the number one test team in the world now. That's how much talent there was. And that was built from playing, free play, dopamine-rich environment where, you know, if you fall and you get hurt, there's no one there next to you with an ice pack or all that malarkey, you know, and get the cryo chamber and the mum's there picking you up. It was genuine building robust, resilient young athletes. And I think now we take them out too early. If you're in an academy setup, you're taken up from rugby at the age of 16. And then you just go into an indoor school with a hard surface in a nice environment, nice lighting, nice and warm. Your volume of bowling is monitored. You can't be too tired. How are we developing athletes there? So I don't mind you taking someone out of rugby because it's dangerous, but you need to fill the athlete in with what they're missing. So you need to replace what they're missing in that sport in their training session. And that doesn't happen because all you're concerned about is bowling and batting. And so I was fortunate in the era that didn't happen. It was rugby in the winter and it was cricket in the summer. And there was a bit of crossover at the end. And that got too much for me in about 98 when I was playing for Somerset. But I remember playing in a game, and here's one for you. I played second team Warwickshire. So I finished at Cambridge. I signed for Bristol Rugby. I played for the second team at Somerset against Warwickshire. I bowled 25 overs in the day because that I was fit. That's what I was built on, really. Then I got in the car. I travelled up to Bristol for a full contact rugby session. And there were some proper rugby players then. It was old school stuff. Contact was contact. And then I traveled in the car straight away up to the Oval, where I played another second team game. And then got in the car and traveled to Wasps. And I played a rugby game against Wasps for Bristol. And then I went in the car to Derbyshire to make my one day debut for Somerset in Derbyshire, the same day that Lady Diana died. That's how I remember it. And it was rained off. And I said, this is not working. I'm just becoming a bit of jack of all trades and a master of none. And so it gets to a stage where when this high performance, when general athleticism, natural ability is not enough, you need to stop. And it doesn't happen till about 18, 19, 20. So a long-winded answer, but you have to be doing lots of different sports. You can't specialize. And then people say, well, what about Tiger Woods? That is not the norm. You know, that's the exception. There are exceptions. There are exceptions, and sometimes those exceptions are exceptional in their ability, which is, they probably go hand in hand, but mostly you need to be doing as much sport as possible.
That's crazy. Yeah. Kind of balance those two sports. Do you think that's something that's attainable now?
No.
I mean, obviously the both games have changed so much. Rugby, yeah. I mean, I'm not like massive on rugby, but obviously I'm pretty big cricket fan. So I can more say for that how much cricket has changed from a fan's perspective, and it really has changed. You've got almost an inside view of that being a coach, but you don't think it's attainable now?
No, no chance. I think there's some who try it, I think, in terms of schoolboy stuff, but very few. I think by the age of 15 now, you go into a pathway, and these pathways and the academies actually don't serve our country very well, I think. They have all good intentions to get into a high performance model very early, but they don't serve the needs of athletic children, in my opinion. I'm presenting in a 3 week time, I think, to the UKSCA. So it's the governing bodies of strength and conditioning, and I'm presenting my view on it. And I genuinely believe that I think we make children specialize too early, and also we give them too much too early. You know, when we go to the well very early in terms of high performance, well, what do we do when that's dry? And that's what I think. I think we give them all too much stuff too early.
Well, that's very, very interesting, Stefan. And of course, we will have to touch upon that as the podcast progresses, because we will. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, there's so much to talk about in today's podcast. But just before we go on, obviously, to the world of fast bowling, strength and conditioning as well, which are two massive pillars of your journey, really, in the past few years. You mentioned there about that West Indies bowling attack of the 70s and 80s. And that just reminded me, who were your early cricketing idols? Who did you look up to in your early cricketing days? Did you have anyone in the professional world of cricket who you like to emulate, per se?
Yeah, well, that is... let me just get sort of technical with it first. So the brain loves it when you give it an intention. So what I say to my kids, you need an intention, you need a goal for you to improve, and it's motor learning. So that's why if you look at a bowler and you try and emulate it, more often than not, you'll turn into that bowl in action. So when I was younger, I used to like Imran Khan and Ian Botham, but they jumped very high and really side on, which... knowing what I do now is not really conducive to bowling quickly. It's all about maintaining momentum through the crease. But one person I always looked up to, and it's pretty random, but bless him, he got killed 2 weeks ago, was Ezra Mosley. He was just, and he reminds me of Jofra Archer. He had a short run-up, but very, it's what I call a tendon-driven bowler, very wiry strength, no muscle bulk, but bowl rapid. And there was something about him that I really, really liked. And yeah, he was one of them, Ezra Mosley, bless him.
Great choice as well. And of course, played in county cricket, didn't he?
Yeah, Ezra Mosley. Up there, wasn't it? Did he play club cricket up north, I think, in Lancashire Leagues, maybe? I don't know.
And of course, played in the county circuit. But I do just have to ask about this, because I read this and it was so interesting. I think it was your analysis of Jofra Archer, and it was about the tendons, and it was about playing beach cricket in Barbados. And of course, Mosley was from Barbados as well. I just wanted to ask you about this. Do you think that where a player comes from can determine how fast that they bowl? Because you mentioned about beach cricket. Here in England, you don't get that. You're going to be playing on very hard surfaces. What are your thoughts on that, Stefan? Please elaborate, because this was so interesting when I read that.
So it's all about what you do when you're younger, because that can have a massive impact on the rest of your life and your athletic quality. So let's go Pakistan and let's go West Indies. Take it back 20 years, because most things are modern and high performance and all this malarkey now. And I'm one of those, you know, I say malarkey flippantly, but I'm one of those. But you've got to keep sort of the old labor farmer's strength, I call it. So Pakistan played a lot of tape ball. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's a light ball, so it's over speed training. And they developed a lot of fast bowlers. You think of Azam Akram, Waqar Yunus, Akib Javed, my favourite, Shoaib Akhtar. You know, these were fast. They're genuine fast. Not like what we call fast these days. And then you had the West Indies who bowled on uneven surfaces, whether that's a field or, you know, you got to go in the fields in the West Indies. And it's like we go over there now with our kids and they look in the field and go, are we going to field on that? And I'm going, hang on, blinking Michael Holding, Ezra Mosley, are these guys bowled on that? You're all right. So and your ankles and your tendons have to work harder. But because if you're on and it develops tendon stiffness, tendon tuning, and that's what it is. It's because when you bowl, you're only on the ground for a fraction of seconds. Strength does not have an impact. Okay. It's all about the tendons, about getting off nice and quickly. So it's not about, because for your muscles to have to work, it has to be between about 0.25 seconds and 0.3 for the muscle to work. Fast bowling happens quicker than that. So it's not muscle. It's about the tendons that connect to the joints. So, and what happens when you go on multiple different surfaces that you don't know whether you've got a ditch coming up to you or your stone coming up to you. You're going to have to get tense ready before you land. And that's what they have, they had. So, and it's you're a product of your environment. And that's why I think when I was between the age of 15 and 16, I dramatically increased my bowling speed to be in the fastest in the country. Not Wales, but just the UK. It was me and Glenn Chapel. And I remember I took 50 wickets in an under-16s competition. But I played a lot of indoor cricket with a light ball. Mm-hmm. So that's over-speed training. And obviously then I played a lot of rugby, so on soft surfaces. And then I'd go indoor. Then I'd have a hard surface in the summer. So I had loads of different surfaces and I could run quickly. I was on the wing, professional rugby, so you're not going to be slow. So it's for all from your environment. And my concern these days is all these youngsters are on hard surfaces. So your Achilles tendon is just, it doesn't have to work. It doesn't have to adapt to any variability in the surface. So it becomes lazy and that impacts then on everything. So if you have a fast bowler that's really heavy, lazy on back foot, they can't open their hips out. They can't separate hips and shoulders, which means they land crossed over, which means they got a lateral flex. And you've got stress fractures everywhere. It's like a rite of passage to professional cricket. Now is having a stress fracture. And that comes down to the PE programs at school as well is no longer play and it's all structured. It's all a sort of a part of a big, big program really that doesn't quite get it right, I think, at the minute.
Fair enough. And of course, Stefan, we have to touch upon this as the podcast progresses. I mean, I'm just sat here engrossed already. I knew this would be a good pod and it's living up to the billing so far. Uh-huh. Of course, we have to talk a bit about your county career in general, yeah. Really. And what were your first memories of county cricket? Because you were born in Wales. I'm guessing Glamorgan would have been a large part of your early days. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was voted Glamorgan's Young Player of the Year when I was 16. So that was my first memory, really. So we played Glamorgan Colts. I played Wales School Boys. There was a good little pathway in Wales. It was you played Wales School Boys. And then I remember watching outside and they came and select and we were like, under Wales, under 13s. And my mother and father were in tears. And then you went up that. And then if you were good enough, when you were Wales under 15s, Tom Cartwright would then go, right, 15-year-old, and pick you for the under 16s to go on a Jersey festival. And I nailed it there as well. When I was 15, 16, it clicked. And then coming back, I got selected for Glamorgan Colts, which would mean then you played in the league. So I think I was the youngest player to be playing for Glamorgan Colts. So I played in the South Wales League, which had Richie Richardson, Keith Atherton, proper pros back then overseas. So I was playing in that. And then after that year, you get signed on a contract. So I signed a summer contract with Glamorgan. So my first ever professional contract was 1990. And I retired when I was in 2010. So that's a 20-year professional career. That's not a bad effort, really. And then, so I'd never made played first class for Glamorgan, though. It was all second team because I still wanted to play rugby, and there was always conflict there. And it came to a head in 97 where I had to decide between Glamorgan cricket and going on a pre-season tour with Cambridge University to Portugal. And we both agreed that it wasn't happening because I didn't know what I wanted to be then. So then I finished with Glamorgan. And then at the end of that year, I remember Ray Julian, Mark Benson were umpiring me for Cambridge at Fenners against Derbyshire. And I bowled ridiculous amount of overs and I bowled very well. It was like a 30 over, 26 overs, I think 2 for 50 or something like that. And they phoned Somerset. They phoned Dermot Reeve. And I was on my teaching practice in a school in Cambridge. I had a phone call with Dermot Reeve. And I was like, he's big back then. You know, he's awesome captain and coach for Warwickshire. Mm-hmm. And he said, do you want to come for a trial with Kent? So I went, I travelled down to Ashford. I played against Kent for Somerset. Somerset seconds. And I think it was Rob Key's debut as well. I think, and I remember Andre Van Troost bowling, who was rapid, bowling for Somerset. And my first ball he bowled was a beamer to Rob Key. And I was thinking, oh my God, this is, this is professional cricket, this is awesome. And then I bowled okay, didn't get wicket. Keith Parsons dropped 2 catches. I still remind him now.
Not bitter, no.
And then someone asked me, I had no idea, man. I was still a rugby player this day. Does anyone want to be a night watchman? Because I think, I don't know if Trescothick was batting or Jason Kerr, my best mate, both of them best mates, they were there. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. I have got no idea what it is. I'll do it. So I went in and I charged the first ball and got caught in ball by a spinner. I was a night watchman.
Not ideal.
And I walked back in and they just all laughed. And he said, you had no idea, were you? And then they signed me then. And I was there for, I played 13 years, I think, at for Somerset. Loved it. Made my debut, first class debut against Pakistan and Shoaib Akhtar. The same day, same game as Stuart McGill made his first class debut for Somerset. So we played Shoaib. I just remember him running in for miles and I thought, that looks awesome. And then a year later, he was playing for Pakistan. And I was supposed to play the first ever day-night game against Warwickshire. I was picked after that game to play for Somerset, made my debut, first ever day-night game. And I think I bowled badly or something, and they didn't take me. And I'm glad because Alan Donald was bowling the speed of light on TV, so I was so glad I didn't have to face that. I loved Somerset. I loved Derbyshire as well. I loved what Derbyshire stood for. Really, that homegrown, tight community, the poor neighbour sort of. The mentality where other people have on it, but I just loved my time there. And I took 120 wickets, I think, in two seasons and a half of them. And yeah, I do love my time. Northants wasn't so good for me. It was a brilliant team. It was a gun team, to be fair, but I changed my action before I arrived there, which didn't work. And it was very dusty wickets. So it was Graham Swan, Jason Brown, Monty Panesar. And I'm not a bowler. So my career was built on the philosophy that for every 10 overs I bowled, I got a wicket. So I needed to bowl 500 overs a season to get 50 wickets, which is the benchmark. And I didn't get that opportunity in Northants. So I looked pretty mediocre, to be honest. If the spectators would look back at me now and go, I had a few games where I was pretty good. But in Derbyshire, I took the season straight after. I took loads, 60 wickets, I think. I was leading wicket taking the country for a long time. So I was a teetotaler. So I took it really seriously. I was a teetotaler until I was 38 years of age. And I went to, didn't drink anything, no alcohol in university, rugby, initiations and all that. Didn't believe in it. Didn't think you could play professional sport and drink. I mocked for it a few times, but my philosophy was, if you want me to play for you, then leave me be. Don't make me drink. And I was that good back then at rugby that they let me be. They preferred me to play. And then I went to Australia for a winter, first time ever, when I was 30, I don't know, late 30s. Well, it must have been late 30s, with Damien Wright. And I just thought, you know what? I'm just going to chill out. I'm just not going to train like a madman like I did. I do train very hard and bowled a lot. And I came back and got 60 wickets for Derbyshire. So, and I started to drink copious amount of rum.
Jeez. I'll tell you what, though, it's funny you mention with regards to the lack of training, or, well, the minimising of training, because you spoke there about Sher Bakhtar, and we've had people here on the podcast who've played alongside Sher before. You're already laughing. I think you know what's coming.
Yeah, he was good, man.
He wasn't exactly the hardest trainer, and just something for fast bowlers. Obviously, you have to tailor it to the fast bowler themselves. But how big of a role did training play in your particular career, Stefan? Because you had a lot of strength and conditioning training. You did a lot off the field. But how big of a role did it play in the success on the field for you?
Everything. It was everything. That my career was built on being fitter than any other cricketer in the world. That's what it. I could bowl. I could bowl the same pace at 6.25 as I did at 10 past 11. And that's what got me the wickets. What got me the wickets was when no one else would bowl, I would bowl. And, you know, there's a few times, you know, my stats in terms of the average, but I did play on flat wickets, is high. But that's because I didn't pick and choose my spells. Like if there was a spell where they were going for runs, quick runs to declare, or there was a dead game, I would still bowl. I'm paid to bowl. I'm not paid to field. And that would hamper my figures now and again. I remember playing against 2003, two other bowlers got injured within the space of three overs, first or three overs of the game, Matt Bulbeck and Richard Johnson. And I was the only seamer then for the North Ants game, for the whole game. I bowled 50 overs that game. And I remember bowling towards the end, something chronic. And that's seamer running in fast from 20, 30 metres. It wasn't a spin bowler. And Mike Hussey was on 300. But I thought, I'm going to get him out. Like that, I was in the battle. And it was always me against the batter. And I was an angry bowler. And I just wanted to run in and bowl as fast as I can, which is now taken into my coaching. But that's actually what signed me for Northants. So that spell there got me signed because my Cassie went to the coach, we have to have him next year. And I was unhappy at Somerset. So I thought, yeah, I jumped at the chance. But the only problem is he then got picked for Australia. So it wasn't my captain when I went.
And the rest is history, of course, with Hussey himself. Yeah. not the worst batsman of all time, any means. But just with regards to your time at Somerset, Stefan, what do you say was your proudest moment down at Taunton? Is there any real highlight? I think 2001, of course, the C&G Trophy, winning at Lord, that would be one. But did you have, obviously, any others, or was that your highlight during your time at Somerset?
That was obviously the highlight. It was an extraordinary event. But getting there as well was a great team. It was the best team that I played with. And maybe not stars, but just the family, and I think that's gone out of county cricket as well. It was a family affair, and everyone enjoyed each other's success. I remember after Benson and Hedges quarter-final game, I had to get pulled off Rob Turner because we just went at each other. We were shouting, and we were just about to get into a brawl. And Daz, the physio, had to pull me off, and Kevin Shine, the coach, had to pull Rob off because we were just so annoyed that we lost, and I blamed everyone else but me. And then we chilled out for 5 minutes, and then we went in this physio room, then talked it over, hugged, and that was it. That we moved on from it, you know. And I know a few cricketers in the recent times who could have done that, and England would have been a better place, really. But I loved Somerset. We were we had a couple of, we had ridiculous spectators, the amount in for a semi-final game against Surrey. Surrey never liked playing Somerset. It's just really bizarre. They were like the Galacticos. There's so many superstars, but we always beat them at Taunton. I think it still happens now, to be honest. But maybe not in recent times, but I'm sure they do. But the final was awesome. The semis, the quarters. I remember the quarterfinals against Kent at Canterbury. I remember bowling a ball Yorkers. I could bowl a Yorker as good as anyone. That's what I was good at. And my record in one day cricket, I got 270 wickets in Sunday League one day, and nobody comes close to that now because I played so much of it, and I bowled at the start, at the end. And again, people would shy away from bowling at the end because you go for runs, but you pay to get wickets, man. It's like, get a wicket. Exactly, yeah. But it was a great time, great period of my life, Somerset.
Well, that's lovely to hear. And of course, for any Somerset fans tuning in, I mean, that'll be music to their ears. And that is the thing. We've had former Somerset players here on the podcast, current as well, Rilla van der Merwe. They do say about that family element down at Taunton. The Somerset supporters are absolutely fantastic. They really are. Like, we can't credit them enough here.
Yeah. And this is no disrespect to Derby and North Ants, because I love playing for them as well, and especially Derbyshire, true salt of the earth people who supported me. I got Player of the Year, Supporters Player of the Year twice in a row, I think, or something. But Somerset is a different beast. It's a the Southwest is just cricket. Now we got extra Chiefs, obviously. But if you live down here, you live and breathe cricket. Mm-hmm. That's why, and it's a product of it. We have about five or six schools around here who feed Somerset. We have Dorset, we have Devon, we have Cornwall close by, and where Somerset is the only first class county. So if you're an aspiring one from those, you come to Somerset, you come up here with your mum and dad, you come on tours up here. You know, I'm so glad this is, it was no reason for it, but I'm so glad that majority of my time was for Somerset. And I've still got good friends there now. You know, Jason Kerr, the head coach, Max Triscothic, are godfathers to my children. So I've still got strong ties with the county.
Well, that's fantastic to hear, Stefan. It really is. And of course, Trez going on with England now, which is fantastic. Yeah. Massive for the Three Lions. Big loss down at Somerset, but I mean, pastures in it, I suppose, and we get to still see him in the England kit now, I suppose, in the coaching.
Yeah, but that's why you do it, isn't it? That's why
of course,
you coach.
Yeah.
You don't coach to, or some might do, but I wouldn't, and I know Trez doesn't, and I know Jason wouldn't. You coach to be the best that you can be. And if the best that you can be will take you up to international, then that's what you'll have to aspire to. You know, you reach for the stars, you might reach the moon, but you can't just be happy with being county coach, which is great achievement. And don't get me wrong, county players. But I always wanted to play for England. I just wasn't good enough. But I always tried to play for England. And Robert Croft used to say, doesn't he, the playing for England is like playing for the British Lions, because I'm Welsh, you know, I speak my Welsh, my first language. I don't speak English to my parents. I speak Welsh. I did all my GCSE and my A-level subjects in Welsh. I went to a Welsh-speaking school, so I'm as Welsh as they come. But I wanted to play for the British Lions or the ECB.
Fair enough, Stefan. Could you teach us any Welsh? What about any cricketing terms or any?
Well, I can teach you Llanfair, Pwllgwyngych, Wgerych, Wynrobwll, Llanysilio, Gogogoch, if you want to. That's the longest town in the world, isn't it?
There it is. I knew it was coming. Every single time you ask either someone who speaks Welsh or someone who knows a Welsh word, that's the one. It's the is it an RAF based there?
I don't know.
Yeah, like around there, yeah.
Yeah. That's on it from the BBC news report. That's how I know it personally. But I do just have a question kind of to emphasise upon that, because you mentioned there about speaking Welsh. Of course, the way Wales runs through your blood, obviously.
Yeah.
Do you regret not playing for Glamorgan? Because you mentioned earlier you had that opportunity. Do you wish you would have taken it?
I just think it's a shame. You know, it is really a big shame, but not through choice. You know, I'm not blaming anyone now, because some coaches have moved on and some passed away, and John Derrick and Tom Cartwright, huge impact on my life, cricketing life. But it was it just wasn't to be. I wasn't good enough to play first-class cricket when I was there as a second-team player because I was trying to play rugby as well. And they wanted me to commit more to Glamorgan. But I wanted to play rugby. Could they have been a bit more flexible? Maybe. Could they have re-signed me in 2003? Maybe, you know. But it is a real shame that a Welsh boy, Welsh-speaking boy who represented Welsh schoolboys in cricket, in rugby, never played first class for Glamorgan. That is quite sad. But we move on, don't we? I had a good career. I've now got a lovely life. I coach around the world. I've still got friends there. They're good people. It's a lovely county. It is represents Wales. But for me not to represent Glamorgan at first class, it just, yeah, that's one that got away, I think, for everyone.
I'd agree. Yeah. And the way in which you spoke about, I read a couple of articles about it. It is a bit of a shame, I must admit, because when you are so proud, it's like us two, isn't it, Joe? I mean, if you didn't play for Lancs, how weird would that be if you were down playing?
Sorry, that gives the impression that I'm going to play for Lancs.
Who knows? Anything's possible.
Well, you never know, but yeah. Exactly. I mean, yeah, that would be weird, though, if I ever was to be fortunate enough to be in that position. To not play for, well, yeah, Lancs would be pretty weird. But
if you did a reverse Luke Wells, you went from Lancs to Sussex.
It's a long way, isn't it? It's a long way.
Yeah. By the sea, though.
That is true. Nice. I bet it's nice in the summer. Can't say I've been, but I bet it's nice in the summer.
I did like playing in Lancashire, though. I did like playing in the Old Trafford. But I will be honest with you, boys, okay? And take this or wherever you want to. But it always rains.
I'm not going to argue there. I'm going to agree with you.
I never played in Old Trafford without missing at least about 10, 15 overs.
Yeah, I can only agree with you.
It could be cracking flags everywhere, but in Manchester it rained. It was just a bizarre. But I remember taking my now wife, like she was girlfriend at the time, over to Wales to meet my parents. This was 2000, and we were going over the Seine Bridge. And I said to her, "You realise that every time you come to Wales, it's going to rain." And I'm no word of a lie. Every time she's gone over to Wales, now for the last 20 years, it's been raining. Honestly, it's just one of these things. Wheels, it just lands in Wales and Manchester.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with you there. It does rain a lot. It does. There's been some pretty crazy games that have been rain affected. There was a Roses game, what was that, 2017, I want to say. And that was that ended as a tie on Duckworth Lewis, and Yorkshire needed like one run.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
That was out, like one run. Oh, I can't remember. But yeah, it basically ended as a tie.
Was there another one as well with Evolve Somerset? Was that 2009 maybe when Andre Adams had to get wickets? Was it Notts win or something? I can't remember, but I just can remember it on TV. And I think I might be wrong, mate. I thought Lancashire were involved in that one against Notts, but I might be wrong.
I can't remember off the top of my head, I'll be honest. But yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. It does always rain. It does always rain. You're not wrong there.
I can say that from experience as well. 2019, made the trip up to Manchester for a T20 Blast game, and as soon as got in there, game got cancelled. It's just England, though, I suppose. Just got to
get on with it.
100%, yeah. And you know exactly what you're in for when it comes to England. But of course there, Stefan, we've touched a lot about the proud moments, the highlights of your career. Of course, cricket isn't that simple. It's not just the journey going upwards, upwards, upwards. It's a roller coaster. There's peaks and troughs. So what do you say was your toughest moment in your county career?
I remember being left out of the 1999 final against Gloucestershire. So I was the leading wicket taker for Somerset. I was up there in the country as well to get us to the final. But I was left out. I had no inclination that I was. I thought it was a given that I was, because I was the death bowler. I nailed it. I got us there. I got four wickets against Sussex. I got Adams. I got Devanuto. I won us the game. We played against Essex a couple of days before, and Stuart Law got hold of me, and it didn't look good. I think if they were picking the team, but I would have thought they would have sort of looked past it was just one game, but it's gone now. And that was tough, being left out at 10 o'clock for a Lord's final, the first one. And I was 12th man, but I actually gave my medal to Adrian Pearson. Because there was something, so Adrian was 13th man and I was 12th. So I made him go up and get the loser's medal. I did. There was something in me that made me say that I was going to come back though. That's the sort of character I am, is that they left me out. So I was not going to sulk and just blame someone else. I was going to make sure that I was good enough for them not to leave me out ever again. And actually, and this was the worst thing about it. So the game finished, obviously, on a Saturday. On the Tuesday night, there was a day night game against Glamorgan, and I came back into the side. So I was playing again. So I played the game before, and I played the game after, and I got 3 wickets on TV. And I remember walking up the steps, and Jamie Cox, the captain, was there. And he looked at me as if to say, yeah. Fair point. Good guy. And I have to say, Jamie Cox is the best captain I've ever had. Justin Langer was a good captain as well. But Jamie Cox just had something. I would have run through a brick wall for him. I would have. And it was just something there that I think was just a little moment. And I remember it now, walking up those stairs, the floodlights still on, got 3 wickets. We won the game on TV. I got the last wicket. And we just looked at each other and I went, do you see? And he sort of looked at me and went, yeah, probably right. But then the player who played for me was Graham Rose. So he came in and hadn't played all year because he was been injured. But then great, you know, an absolute legend of a guy, of a gentleman, and so talented. He used to get 1,000 runs and 50 wickets in a season. If someone did that now, they'd have the MBE, man. They'd be the first name on the team sheet. But actually, he did it. It was that Graham Welsh is another one who did it. Nobody can do that anymore. And he had the opportunity of representing Somerset in a Lord's final. I know we lost against Gloucestershire, who were a cracking team back then. But it was bittersweet, I think. I'm happy he got that opportunity because I think a year later he was retiring. And he, up till that point, Graham Rose served Somerset far, far more than I ever did. Obviously, after that, I did okay for Somerset. So it was tough for me, but looking back at it, I'm glad it happened, actually.
That must be quite, you know, tough to take, as you say. You've been the guy in terms of the ball. The go-to guy with the ball, and to miss out on the final like that, it must have been really, really tough.
Yeah, it was horrible. It was, and my dad, I could just see my dad's face when he was walking towards me. It was like, yeah, not good. Not good.
No, not at all. So let's kind of go along in a similar vein then, in terms of toughest moments, but let's kind of change the question up a little bit. And let's talk about individual players. Who would you say the toughest batsman that you ever bowled to was? Is there anyone who really stands out in terms of county, overseas, you know, whoever?
I always come back to this. I get this question quite a bit, but I always come back to bowling in the nets. Max Truscoglu was a shocker. I didn't have any answers for him, really. It was ridiculous. His bat looked as wide as the back net. So my best balls, he would just run down for one in nets. And he had me. He was too good for me. So batting, playing, and he's just an absolute legend of a guy as well. And I'm so happy he's got this gig because English cricket needs Marcus Truscoglu. It really is that simple. Opposition, Darren Lehman was a shocker to bat to bowl to as well. He made me look as if I bowl throwdowns. The ball I bowled for someone else would get them out, but the ball I bowled for Darren, same ball to Darren Lehman would go for one. So he would get one off my belting balls and hit the rest for four. So he was, and he was another natural talent. Kevin Peterson was incredible. And, you know, and Kevin, I wouldn't have a bad word to say, that controversial thing to say, but everyone's entitled to the opinion. But I wouldn't have a bad word to say about Kevin Peterson, if I'm honest. He came down here to speak. He came down here to take a masterclass for the school. We invited other schools, local kids around. They came in. He was outstanding for them. And this was when the height of his fame. And then he went back to the hotel and then came back and we did a fundraising evening for a tour and he answered questions. He was outstanding, sat at the table, was just an absolute delight. So talented, such an extraordinary batter that it's just a shame we didn't get to see more of his talent, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely is. Yeah. I mean, I think Kevin Peterson, this is a big word to use in terms of a big statement to make, almost generational. You could argue, you know, he's, as you say, an extraordinary cricketer. He really is. And some of the performances that he put in for England were just phenomenal. Is there anyone who you have kind of identified in the county game nowadays who could live up to those standards or could be as good as Kevin Peterson?
Yeah, but you've just got to watch some of the videos of him playing, and you got no business playing that shot. That's just ridiculous. You were seeing but the difference between, you know, everyone can work hard and everyone can work ethic and natural talent, but it's actually your reaction. The very best react quicker, make the best decision to that particular ball. That's what separates the best from the rest. Having the right decision at the right time. Because you compare my cover drive to Kevin Peterson's cover drive, it would be pretty much, I could drive a ball to be honest, but it would pretty much be very similar because it is what it is. But me doing that against a 99 miles per hour Brettley at the Oval, No, I'd have been 5 hours late on the ball. And that's what the best do. And I see a few of that. I see Josh Butler is another. Do you know what? The best are also good people. Mm-hmm. They're also good human beings. You look at Tendulkar, you know, Virat Kohli is bravado, but he's actually a really nice guy. Steve Smith, who obviously I was with the Royals, is an absolute legend of a guy. The very best are just good people. Just you tend to get the band, the wannabes in the middle band there, who are the ones who are more concerned with their social media and their profile, who think they're professional cricketer because they've been signed for 2 years. That's not a professional cricketer. You've got to have at least 10 years to be a professional cricketer. So Josh Butler, Sanju Samson for the Royals. Oh, he's just absolute talent, man. Absolute talent. So those actually, if I could think of more, but straight off the top of my head, Josh Butler and Sanju Samson.
Good choices. Wow.
Yeah, very, very good players. And I'm going to throw another name in there that, I mean, I don't know how much, you've probably seen a decent amount of him. And he's more up and coming, a younger player, and that's Tom Banton.
Yeah.
How good is he?
I don't know much about him.
Do you not? No.
No, I don't. I know he played against us. I did know at the time. He played for Kings against Wellington when I started this job and we weren't very good. And he played there, apparently. I can't remember him. But then I haven't seen a lot of him. But if Marcus Trescothick and Jason Kerr say he's a talent, that'll do me.
He must be, yeah. Well, fair enough. And as you said there, Butler, Samson, some absolute quality gun cricketers. Yeah, without a doubt. And let's flip the toughest batsman question on its head then. What about the toughest bowler who you faced? Is there anyone who springs to mind?
Yeah. I did get 2 first-class 100s. I think people forget that. I could bat.
We were going to mention that.
Yeah.
I averaged, 20 in first-class cricket. That's not a bad effort for someone who batted most of the time at 10 and 11. So I could bat. I love my batting. But there was a funny thing. There was nobody. I remember facing Shoaib Akhtar, and that was frightening. That we were 10 for 5 against Durham.
Is he the quickest bowler you've ever faced?
By country mile. But he bowled full. He never bowled a short ball to me because he coached me in the Indo school at Somerset One. He came and guest appearance for Somerset against Australia in a game, and he took me for a session. I said, "Can you do some work with me?" And ever since then, he messaged me. I was just a random comment, but 3 years ago, I was with my staff here in Pizza Express at Taunton, and my phone rang. WhatsApp. I had no idea, so I picked it up and answered it, and it was Shoaib Akhtar. And it was Shoaib Akhtar phoned me and said he loves the stuff that I put on social media. He loves the way I try and coach fast bowlers, and that mindset of bowling fast is the number one priority. And it was just a random, and I was in front of my staff, my PE staff. It was just a random, but he was awesome. I faced Brett Lee, I faced Shane Warne, I faced Glenn McGrath. Sean Tate was nasty as well because it was short. Faced Malinga. I did for 2 fours of the last over. Flintoff was hard, but I faced him when he was coming back from recovery off a short run, and I thought, oh, that's not right. That looks a bit fast for someone who's coming off about 2 paces. And he hit the bat hard. Glenn Chappell bowled a fast spell at me at Old Trafford. I was night watchman, and I don't think he pitched one up. And it was tasty, but I loved it. I loved it. They were quick. But Shoaib was just ridiculous. Ridiculous. But you know that. So I'm big on weighted ball bowling. That's my sort of what I'm known for. But Shoaib did weighted ball bowling, but he bowled rocks. So he bowled rocks training. So he bowled a stone. 1 week was heavier. Then next week he'll go even heavier. So it was specific strength training. I don't know if he was doing it on purpose, but that's how we trained as well.
That's fascinating to know.
Yeah.
Can't say I knew that before.
Yeah, he bowled rocks. He bowled rockets. I know that. Gee, was fast.
Yeah, there's a reason why he has, 100 mile an hour in his Twitter bio.
there's actually... At Old Trafford, under the media centre, there's not a monument. It's more like basically something on the wall of when he bowled that delivery.
A plaque.
Yeah, a plaque thing. Yeah, it was.
But he could bowl. He could bowl as fast off a short run as he could off a long run. But I spoke to him and he said, "People haven't come to watch me off a short run," and that sat with me ever since. So I'm not a big fan of fast bowlers off a short run. You know, I did it later on in my career because it's what I did because I was a knee dominant bowler back then, but we won't go into that. But he could bowl as fast off a long run, off a short run as a long run. But he said, "I want to bowl as fast as I can for 5 years than bowl medium pace for 15 years." And that's Shoaib. Just Shoaib. And we haven't got enough of those these days.
Well, I'll tell you what, he was a unique character as well, weren't he, Shoaib Akhtar? But quality bowler, quality bowler. As you said, obviously, myself and Joe, we never faced him. But I imagine he would have been an absolute nightmare.
Just watch videos of him YouTube bowling, man. You watch some games now, and it's not back in my days sort of chat, but you watch games these days on TV and you can see the ball, you can see the way the batter reacts, and it's like, and it comes up 85 miles per hour. That's not 85 miles per hour, trust me. Okay, I live with my speed gun. I know what 85 miles per hour is. And you watch him bowl on YouTube, and now you go the batter is just hasn't got any time to move, and that tells you right there that was fast.
Well, he was. He was lightning quick, wasn't he?
Yeah.
To be fair, over the years as well, you mentioned Sean Tate, called the Wild Thing. Remember him bowling absolute rockets against Pakistan at the MCG.
Yeah, I coached him. So I was with the Hobart Hurricanes with him. Another lovely fella, man. Same as Stuart Broad. Another lovely fella. He's when you're at the top, man, they're good people. And Sean Tate, it was a shocker to take the mitt to because it came so low but so fast. My hands got a hammer in.
he had a slingy action as well, didn't he, Sean Tate?
Yeah, it was
really good. Extended back.
Yeah, it was good for him. It was good for how he was built. That's the thing, you know. A bowler will bowl how his or her body wants to move. We can't be forcing them into a position that their body doesn't want to go in. Just because it looks good on someone else doesn't mean your body's going to be able to do that. And that's why I go down the route of, they call it attractors and specific descriptors, I call it. They're key points of a bowling action that everyone do. But in between them, there's individuality. You wouldn't say that Brett Lee and Jimmy Anderson look the same, but at key points of the action, they do exactly the same.
100%. And that goes back to Ian Pont's 4 tent pegs, doesn't it? In terms of that real basic principle.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned Jimmy Anderson there, because Stefan, just from that little piece there, I don't think that you, well, this is just my assumption, please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but you're not a massive fan of changing technique, because Jimmy, of course, changed his technique. And ever since he did change it to what may be considered a bit more unnatural, because it wasn't his natural way of delivering the ball, but it's a bit more efficient. It's easier on his body. And of course, ever since he's made the change, he's become one of the world's best, if not the world's best swing bowler. What are your opinions on changing techniques at a later stage?
Well, it's a tough one. For me, you've got to change technique if it's not working. If you're always injured and it doesn't work, there's no point keeping doing the same rubbish all the time. You've got to change your technique. So, but I don't like changing technique for the sake of it. But you've got to remember, and the people who watch cricket, and say, for example, that Jimmy Anderson, the coaches and Jimmy had the best intention in mind when he was trying to change his action. He didn't try and change his action just because he wanted a laugh or it was bored one day. He wanted to change it for a reason. So all the coaches and the game itself have the best intentions for each player. And it didn't work for whatever reason. I don't know. Here's the thing for you and the people listening. How long did it take him to revert back to the old? Not very long at all. Not very, I don't know, was it half a season? So that straight away tells me that the new action wasn't supposed to be for Jimmy Anderson, because he's unlearned it so quickly. And that is the thing, that bowling action needs to match up with what I call anthropometry, with how you built. It needs to match up with it. And it needs to be communication with the strength and conditioning coach and the technical guys. Because the strength and conditioning guys want big, strong bowlers who can squat lots and have big numbers on the whiteboard. Whereas the technical guy, the old-fashioned coach, just wants a bowler who runs through the crease quickly, light on their feet, nice and wiry, and can bowl all day and bowl quickly. Well, they need to talk to each other, because what they're doing is not what the other one wants to do. So if you want big squats and big strength, then you need to become a slinger. You need to be a Sean Tate. You need to be a Shoaib Akhtar. You need to be a Fidel Edwards. You need to be a Mitchell Johnson. Yeah, so it's communication is key. That's why every coach should have the knowledge on all aspects of human performance, which is called the governing dynamics. That's why I'd like to think I'm pretty unique, and it's not blowing my own trumpet, but I played a bit. I know technique. And I know I'm a qualified strength and conditioning coach as well. So some people I coach might never need to see a weight. They might never need to see a barbell. They're strong enough. Like, getting stronger will not help them, but getting faster will help them. And another person who's really fast already comes to me really fast, then there's no point me trying to get them any faster. They're already fast. They need to get stronger. So it's an individualized approach to coaching fast bowlers. That's what's really important. There's no one size fits all. Fast bowling is 3 Olympic events. It's a sprint, it's a triple jump, it's a javelin. So do we think that that's okay to to not sort of give it the respect it deserves? It's like, yeah, don't get me started. I could be here all day talking about that.
We could be here all day talking about it as well, because it is such a fascinating topic, especially for myself as a spinner. Joe, I know you don't bowl absolute thunderbolts either, but just, we haven't really discussed fast bowling in depth here on the podcast. And we're talking there about bowling fast. And this, we had a fantastic listener question here from Frank Ped One. And he said, how much of an impact do you think that genetics has on being able to bowl fast? Is it natural or can it be nurtured? What are your opinions on that, Stefan?
About 48% of it.
That much, really?
Yeah, precise, yeah. 48%, wow. 48% of you are born with. It's in your genes, it's in your DNA, and it's phenotypes. So your 48% of speed and strength you're born with. Again, it's to do with a lot of different things, the length of your bones, your fiber makeup, fast twitch fibers, slow twitch fibers. But so you're born to bowl 90 miles per hour. You're born to bowl general speed. So, but my thing is that gives you the pace flow. Okay, this is how I describe it to the kids, is that you're born with a pace flow. Okay, but the right training, the correct training for you can push your pace ceiling up. And everyone can bowl faster. And at the end of the day, a 78 miles per hour outswinger hitting top of off is not going to be as effective as an 82 miles per hour outswinger hitting the top of off. Despite whatever old-fashioned coach will tell you, it's physics, it's reaction time. Okay, if the same delivery is bowled a bit quicker, then, you know, it's a better delivery. It's simple, really. That's why when I go on about everyone can bowl quicker, it doesn't mean that everyone's going to be bowling 90, 100 miles per hour. Very few do it. How many do it now? About 5. Okay, and they're getting less and less, but it's the ability to bowl quicker than you are now if you get your training right. So, but my pace flow is different to Jofra Archer. Jofra Archer is already on the 8th floor, and I'm on the 4th floor. Okay, and if we do the same training, he's always going to be faster than I am. But if my training is better than his, I could catch him up. I could catch him up and he could just, but he will always maybe just cruise or have a bad day or an off day out of rhythm. He'll always be faster than I am. I could be on song, in rhythm, feeling awesome, but still not as fast as him. But I'm bowling quicker than I was last year.
Interesting.
And that is, there's a lot of, there's a lot of science to it as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Like, do you think that kind of has anything to do with, of course, I mean, they're different cricketers, but you've got Chris Broad and Stuart Broad, obviously both played at one of the top levels. Obviously, Chris Broad was a batter, Stuart Broad a fast bowler. But do you think, like, it's almost father-son thing has anything to do with it or not?
Yeah, definitely. It's talent. It's in the genes, man. It's just playing top level, batting as good as Chris Broad was. It's clearly going to have a positive impact on your child coming through.
Yeah, definitely.
But there's a lot of things, social economical factors to it as well. You know, if you're talented, the generation thing, if you're talented at that era, your son then is going to go into the best school. He's going to have the best facilities, the best coaches, and then that's going to squeeze the sponge, as I say. It's going to get, it doesn't mean you're going to make it, but it's going to give you a better opportunity to make it. And then it's a vicious cycle, you know, and that's why most cricketers know. I was a state school boy. I was a state school boy in Llanelli, Ysgol Gyfun Estrade. I love the school. I would go back there tomorrow, and I love my time there. But most cricketers now are private school. And it's not, and trust me, it's not because the quality of the cricket is better. Some of the cricket I see is appalling. But what they get is they get a one-to-one coaching twice a day, every day. They get an S&C program. They get all the fancy kit, and they train every day. We have nets outside. We have 4 squares. We have a 5-lane indoor net full run-up. I have 3 gyms here. I have 2 squares and an outside net and a swimming pool, and that's what they get. So I'm going to squeeze the sponge dry. But the quality of the Saturday cricket is not good. That's not why that's not why private school develop cricketers. It's the amount of time. It's the repetition. And it's the quality of the practice, you know. And who are directors of sport or professional cricket coaches at schools? They're ex-pros. It's like, it is a vicious circle, man. It's, but I would love, you know, but I was, like I said, I was a state school boy. I love my state school roots, and I try and have that ethos at school. We have a state school mentality of appreciating everything, taking every opportunity, not taking anything for granted, but in a private school setting with the programs. That's what it's about for me.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it would be great to almost break the mold one day and see more state school county cricketers and international cricketers as well. That would obviously be great.
Money, isn't it? Because state schools, you're judged by your A level results, you're judged by your academic success. So you're never ever going to spend money on a net or a one-to-one coach.
No.
It's always going to be on a computer or an extra book, or which I, do you know what? Who am I to judge it? But that is the way of the world. Whereas
that's how it is, yeah.
Yeah, whereas private school, you don't pay for that. You pay for the extras you get. That's what separates private school, because I got to pay as well. And, you know, my two daughters do 10 hours of activity a week. And if you're in state school, you'd have 30 minutes in a group of 40. It's quite sad, but that's above us, boys. That's government stuff, that is.
Yeah, it is. And I think if there's one thing British sport can take from, let's say, American sport, British schools can take from American schools, it's the attitude towards sports. If you look at, you know, college football, college basketball, everything like that out there, you don't have to pay to go to a private school and you get in the NBA draft, for example. Yep. The opportunities are endless if you're an American sportsman or sportswoman. In England, it's, as you say, so restricted.
Definitely. We should be having more sports success, and we should be having more elite athletes at this school, at this country, which we don't.
Yeah.
So there's a blockage somewhere in the pathways. I have my opinions, but that's a bit too controversial for here. But we should be better than we are. You know,
what we've won,
you know? Look at New Zealand, man. What's that about? They were in the cricket final, and their rugby team is incredible.
Yeah.
And that is not from everyone being in a private school or in a pathway when they're under nines and this and that, an elite pathway and all that. It's in culture, it's in them. That want, that desire, to be better and represent their country. I'm not saying we don't like represent the country here, but we should be better at sport than we are.
Exactly.
I don't think many people would disagree with that, to be honest. And of course, New Zealand. Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the rugby, they're pretty much born and bred, aren't they? They're same with Australian cricketers, to be honest. It's the exact same principle. But Stefan, we did actually have a few listener questions for today's episode. And this one is about the IPL, because, of course, you do work very, very closely with the Rajasthan Royals. You're the fast bowling development coach for the Royals, which is Joe's franchise, funnily enough. So,
well, kind of.
You just like the English players.
Yeah, basically.
But that's what the Royals try and do. They try and become the UK sort of franchise, because the owner is Manoj, who's based in the UK.
Well, there we go. Personally, I'm an RCB fan, so maybe for me, not so much. But this is from Evan, who is a massive Rajasthan Royals fan. Who would you say is the most exciting young talent that you've seen at Rajasthan so far?
Good question.
There's a lot.
Obviously, fast bowling wise, you've got Kartik Tyagi and Akash Singh. They're, you know, I actually coached three, and I forget his name, to be honest, but the three Indian under-19s bowlers in the World Cup, I actually coach. But those two are very, very exciting. I forget his first name, but Jayaswal.
Yashashvi.
Yeah,
originally.
Yeah, proper talent. But they're everywhere, honestly, in India. It's the most extraordinary country, and I'm fortunate and humbled and always remember that. I'm thankful for the support that I get from India at the minute, because at the minute it's gone bonkers for Stefan Jones, which is great. You know, I worked hard for it. And I will always remember, always be thankful for that. But they have a desire to be bowled quickly and be, they want to be the next Rahul Dravid or the Virat Kohli or the Sachin Tendulkar, don't they? And then, but for me, it's, I always take it back. He's not young, but I always take it back to my man, Samson, Sanju Samson. He is just an extraordinary talent. He is. So the youngsters, you've got your Rian Parags. But for me, fast bowling, you've got those two, Tyagi, Akash Singh and Jayaswal as a batter.
Fair enough. I like Rian Parag personally with the Assam connection. He used to be an absolute beast on, was it Cricket Manager? Was that what it's called? Joe, you'll know this.
Something like Cricket Captain.
Cricket Captain. Say,
something like that.
Cricket Captain. Yeah.
He is a belter. He is a typical young, new generation cricketer. He's got these dancing. He's got the Bhangra down to a T. And he's got, he's a lovely lad. Lovely lad.
Well, got some good music taste as well, Rian Parag. But I do just have a question about one of the Raw's new pickup. Someone who I saw in the side, Mushtaq Ali Trophy. And that's Chetan Zakaria. Because his backstory is so interesting. 22 years of age. From Saurashtra, he's going to be joining the fast bowling core alongside the likes of Chris Morris, of course, who the most expensive IPL player of all time, and then alongside him, Mustafizur Rahman. Who do you see the new core are you really looking forward to working with in this year's IPL?
Well, I'm not going to be working with them this year. It doesn't work. It logistically doesn't work for
us. Not even on Zoom?
I don't know. It's not because we've only just finalised the playing staff. So I don't know because my main role is here as director of sport, and it worked. It's been worked for the last 2 years because we could plan ahead. So I could go, right, I'm going to this IPL. Headmaster, can I have leave? Yes, you can, Stefan. The next year, can I have this head leave? No, you can't. You're not having 10 weeks off again, but you can do this and that. But this year we can't plan it. So, there's nothing, there's no development stage. There's no pre-competition because we might be in an IPL next week. So it's difficult to plan. But I know the players, obviously, and they've asked me my opinion on certain players. But I know JDU Natkat very well. So JDU Natkat came here. So JDU Natkat spent 2 weeks with me in Wellington School, along with Varun Aaron and Dhaval Kulkarni. So they were here. And Ishan Sharma will be coming over at some stage as well. I know he's not Royals, but I also help him. And
just 100 tests.
Yeah, 303 wickets. Yeah, not bad bowler.
No, another lovely guy, man. Another top gentleman. So obviously JD would know the youngster very well, but I don't know a lot about him, if I'm being honest.
Well, who knows, Steph? You could get a chance. And if you do with Chetan Zakaria, he'd be an interesting one. I did like watching him for Saurashtra. But our next question comes from Aditya, good friend of mine at Cricket Fanatics magazine. He says, what's the ideal release point that a fast bowler should aim for to achieve maximum velocity?
Well, it'll be over your front leg. So wherever, that's like, that is a consequence though. It's people sort of worry about the finer detail. There's bigger fish to fry earlier in the chain than that. You know, you need to run in quickly. You need to run in 20% of ball velocity comes from your run up. So you need to run in as if, like you mean it. You need to come off the back foot quickly. You need to separate your hips and shoulders. You need a braced front leg. You need that contralateral extension position, what I say, which is your arms are parallel to the floor in sort of an X position. And then the release point, if they want an exact detail, would be over the front leg. Direct line over your right hip if you're right arm bowler, just released just straight down over your front foot. But that will happen as a consequence to get everything else right. Because you and I know if you try and bowl a ball, you're going to release it. You're going to release it because you have one intention, is to bowl the ball. So that's your one cue. What your brain, your conscious mind thinks of is bowling a ball. So you're not going to not bowl it. And the ball will be released at a position where you want it to go towards the stump. So, but that's the thing. People just think too much about hopefully that's answered the question.
Well, it has. And you mentioned there about the run-up, because I was watching an Alan Donald masterclass, as you do, late last night. in South Africa. I mean, Alan Donald, White Lightning, Warwickshire legend, simple as that. But he mentioned about his run-up, and when he was a young bowler, he was very flat-footed. He didn't have a spring in his step. And actually, when he was in Birmingham, he hired Linford Christie's running coach, and he allowed him to actually learn how to run properly. Stefan, for any young bowlers out there, how do you actually run properly? How can you maximise that 20% per se? Do you have any methodologies per se?
Yeah, you need to learn to sprint. Hmm. So, you know, if you have a choice of doing weights or sprinting, it should always be sprinting. You know, bowling is on your feet. Bowling is locomotive. Bowling is not under a barbell. And there's things like technically where when you move, your muscles, when you're not moving, your muscles just hang there. And then when you move, they tense. But the movement, fast movement, doesn't allow you enough time to tense properly. So you need to tense before you do an exercise or bowl. So when you're doing a squat, that actually creates tension for you. And it's what's called reducing muscle slack. So then your muscles are already working. But when you're bowling, you haven't got a barbell on your back. So that's why you need to train that ability to do it, to pre-tense your muscles, to make them tense before you hit the floor. Sprinting is essential for fast bowlers. And you can go into the technical side of sprinting, where the foot contacts, more front side mechanics than rear side mechanics. So loads of arms, you know, the momentum, angular velocity and all that. But in simple terms, you need to learn to sprint properly.
Absolutely, of course, yeah. And for those who do want to watch that masterclass, as I said, it's on YouTube. You can watch it for free. But we do just have another couple more questions, Stefan, before we end today's podcast. And you mentioned there beforehand the brace front leg. So first of all, how important is it? And second of all, do you have any drills that could actually, you know, make this better, how it could be improved in a young fast bowler?
Yeah, so every bowler I have has two preconceived ideas, and that is opinion of an old coach that would have taught them another way. And another thing is a pattern, a motor engram. So it's a pattern in the brain that's really hard to change. So you have a bowling technique, and that's a motor engram, that's a pattern, and you'll never change that. That'll always be with you. But what you have to do is create a stronger one, a better one. And that's why when people say, oh, revert to type, he's actually gone back to the old model. And that's what happens. So you don't lose the old action. You've just got to make the new one a better action. And that needs to be braced front leg. But it's really important to remember that a braced front leg doesn't mean locked and hyperextended. Like, that is not something that I coach. But if some bowlers do it, like Alan Donald, that's fine. You just need to strengthen the muscles around that capsule, the VMO and stuff. So as long as if you can land slightly flexed, but don't bend it, you need to manage the force and not flex anymore. So if you flex anymore, you lose energy, you lose the height of the center of mass, you lose momentum, everything. Okay, you have leakages in the chain. So it's not going to go through to the ball. But if you land and don't bend anymore, then that's fine. But you can stabilize your leg by doing sort of what I designed. It's called the skill stability paradigm. It's a continuum of exercise based on isometric holds. So you've got to hold a movement. You've got to groove that pattern. You've got to create the feel. You've got to train the tendon, the tendons, the muscle, so the whole capsule around the knee, activate the muscles at the right time. And then you've got to work it. You've got to put that chunk then. You've got to blend it into the action. So that gives you motor skill. Okay, that gives you motor skill. But motor performance is a different beast. That's bowling. So for bowlers who do a drill and then next week think that's going to go into their action, that's not happening. That's not how the brain works. You need to blend it slowly. So what I do is like a superset. So they would hold a front foot contact, isolate it, make sure it's in the right position, feet under your hips, the height of the delivery stride, probably 3/4 of your height, heel contact on the front foot, ball of the foot and the back foot, so put something underneath the heel so it doesn't touch, and then hold that position. Put a weight on your back, make it harder, get someone to push you, to add variability, that makes it harder, and then
do a walk-through bowl, but never do a walk-through bowl with a cricket ball because your brain is bored of that. You need to have maybe have a dumbbell or a super heavy ball. You've got to, first thing the coach needs to understand is how the brain works. Motor learning, that's so important. You know, neurodynamics, neurology, all that needs is the priority for a coach to know how the brain acquires a skill. Because if people who follow me on social media will see, you know, I can change someone who bowls with the wrong foot, that can be changed in an hour. That, because that is a totally different pattern. That is left and that's right. They're different. Problems happen when you've got small changes to make. And that's where the skill of the coaches come in and understanding how to unlock old patterns and create new ones. And that's why, you know, a bowler, I'm pretty transparent with all my bowlers. Bowler now was collapsing on his front leg 4 weeks ago. Now bowls 5 miles per hour quicker with a braced front leg. But I have the gadgets. I have the time. Hopefully I've got the knowledge and I've got the desire to do it. So, and that's all I do. You know, I came out of the game to coach fast bowlers to bowl faster. I've studied hundreds of bowlers. I have data over 300 bowlers. I know what the best do. I know what Jofra does. And I know what my 11-year-old daughter does. And they do some things the same. So then for me, it's about training them to do every bowler to do those points.
That is absolutely fascinating. And of course, for anybody listening to today's podcast, give Stefan a follow on social media. I follow it personally. As I said, I'm not a fast bowler by any means, but it's absolutely incredible in terms of learning all of that stuff. I mean, I've learned some incredible stuff over the past few months with it, to be honest, that I've actually taught, well, not taught people, but told people, let them know about. I mean, I'm not a fast bowling expert by any means, but it is a fantastic resource. It really is, Stefan. Thank you. You mentioned there Jofra. Joe, I'll pass over to you for this one because this is from Ollie Herrington, again, a long-term follower of us here at the Carrick Cricket Podcast, but it may involve Jofra, potentially.
So this question, pretty simply, is who is your favourite bowler that you've ever worked with?
Let me answer. So Jofra Archer is, if I was designing a fast bowler, it would be Jofra Archer. It's just...
That's high praise.
Just everything about him is just, I would improve his back foot stiffness a bit, but when you watch Jofra bowl, watch his joints. The joints don't move. There's not a lot of movement in his joints when he lands. So his back foot, if you land on back foot contact when you bowl, your heel shouldn't touch. Your heel is the human handbrake and you shouldn't be decelerating from back foot to front foot because you've lost all the energy that you've legged it in with. So, and then if you hit your heel, you do lose a lot. Some lose like 2 meters per second. I've got the data. But what's Jofra, he lands quite flat-footed, but he doesn't move again. The foot of the angle of the ankle and the knee remains the same through the full range. So he keeps every energy that he gets from his short run-up. He doesn't run in slowly, by the way. He runs in at what everyone else does. But what Jofra does, he makes it look easy. If all the best athletes are the efficient ones, efficiency is what separates the best athletes from everyone else. And he's as efficient as you'll get. And he is awesome. He's a fabulous, fabulous cricketer. But I enjoy working with youngsters, if I'm honest. You know, I enjoy working with the ones who just before pro and they might never be a professional. The ones like the Rajasthan Royals or the Stuart Broads, the Sean Tates, the Dan Christians, they're already good, man. They're there. They're there at the level. Your best coaches need to be the level below that. I'm not saying I'm the best coach, but you need to be a level before that. That's why the role at Rajasthan is developmental coach. So I'm hopefully going to develop a generation of local Indian fast bowlers that ultimately might save Rajasthan Royals some money. They don't have to spend lots on overseas. But it's the level below that's the key. And I've had some great ones here. You know, Craig Dorado weighed 58 kilograms. 58 kilograms. I don't think I was born that. Bowled 85 miles per hour. On the same speed gun that Jofra Archer bowled 85 miles per hour with. He's opening the bowling for school. Tommy Sturgis, who's hopefully going to have a go with Derby, bowled 85 miles per hour, but totally different, small, stocky. It was like a mini-me, stocky, but both fast, would score 100 and get 5 wickets, schoolboy. But hasn't made it yet, but hopefully would one day will. That's what excites me. Obviously, working at the top with those guys is just a massive honour. Varun Aaron is just the best human being you'll see, man. And he was a pleasure to work with, a student of fast bowling. So when he listens to me, I go, ooh, I must know what I'm talking about then if Varun Aaron is listening to me, because he knows his stuff as well. Well, he's MRF. He's MRF, like, ambassador. So, and they were. Pace Lab is now the number one for fast bowling. But
brilliant. And, of course, Varun Aaron. Yep, my namesake. In that regard, but yeah, again, used to play for RCB as well. But Stefan, before we end what's been an absolutely fascinating podcast, I mean, I've loved every single minute of this chat tonight, I really have. What does the future hold for yourself? What does the future hold for Stefan Jones? What can we expect from both yourself and Pace Lab heading into the future?
That's a good question. So I'm in a good place. The first thing for me is family. Family is priority over anything else. Mm-hmm. So that's why I retired, man. I could be still in county cricket now, or maybe even England head coach. You know, I don't know, because it's been 10 years. But I come out because I wanted to live in the Southwest, provide for my family in this school, live down here because my wife is down here. And then so family is number one. So as long as they're happy, I'm happy. What do they say? Happy wife, happy life and all that.
That's it.
But I love Wellington School. I love the school I'm at now. I love the principles. I love what it stands for. I love the kids that we develop, and I love the cricket and the sports program. So I'll always be here. But how much of me is here is that's the issue. And then Pace Lab is growing by the second. It's growing. I've got a good guy here, Ben Howe, who's helping me with the business side of it. He's an ex-pupil here, so a good little story. He's now helping me run it. We have the online programs. Baseball is going mad for me at the minute, which is great.
So, seen that on Twitter, yeah.
if you want the basics of it, I see myself having Hubs Pace Lab. Some of me here at Wellington School, Pace Lab Hubs in India and Bangalore and Rahul Dravid Academy. That's where I am. That's where I live. I love the place. It's lucky awesome. Fella. Yeah, Rahul Dravid. If you're affiliated to Rahul Dravid, you're doing all right. he's the number one. He is the number one. So I'm based there, and I'll be going over there 4 or 5 times a year. Fast bowlers from all around India come there, and I coach them for a week. I've got a hub in Toronto in Canada. So that's good. And then I'm looking for small little hubs then in the UAE, Australia, maybe with Damien Wright in Tasmania. So I'll have hubs around the world where I go to coach, and then they're affiliated to coach the Pace Lab way, because it is different. You know, it takes a bit of science knowledge and a bit of courage to do it this way, because it is about doing it based on individual needs. And it might mean that you turn in your bowler into a slinger, which is low trajectory, which is like, what are you doing? Actually, that might be right for how they're built. So it's just having courage and being bold, being different, questioning status quo, but dealing in facts and data. That's Pace Lab. Hubs around the world, and then going to Major League Baseball. I'd love to do Major League Baseball for 2 years. I've presented to Chicago Cubs, so I presented for 200 of their staff, which was a great. And I know there's a podcast just been released with Rob Hill, who's the LA Dodgers lead pitching coach. And we did a podcast together last year, which was voted the most watched podcast on that website of all time. So there is stuff happening that side, but I just still got a bit to do with Pace Lab. And I consult. You know, I love helping the Rajasthan Royals. I love the franchise, what it stands for, the players, and India. Did you know where I belong? It's 3 places. It's Wellington School, India, Major League Baseball. I could have answered that like 3 minutes ago, couldn't I?
Well, no, Stefan, it's no issue. I mean, we're glad that you who actually went into a bit more detail. And of course, us two here at the Carrick Cricket Podcast, both myself and Joe, wish you nothing but the best of luck.
Thank
As
you.
I said, yeah, the resources that you provide, I mean, even for free on Instagram, are absolutely fantastic. They really are. They're so helpful. I know people who messaged us for this podcast saying how much it's helped them as well on their journey to becoming a fast bowler. So, I mean, as I said, wish you the best of luck. Baseball would be interesting. Out of interest, who would you go for if you could choose one of the clubs?
I have no idea. I have no idea. Whoever. I think whatever job you do in life, you need to go, not for the money, but go for the people. Mm-hmm. People around you, like-minded people. So, you know, the Chicago Cubs with Adam Beard there was Wales and British Lions S&C. I'm talking to him. So I'd go wherever there's like-minded individuals who put the needs of individuals, players, before anything else, really. And yeah, hopefully that'll come. If not, I'm happy.
Well, fingers crossed that it does, Stefan. As I said, it would be absolutely fantastic. And we do wish you the best of luck. But that does bring us to an end to what's been an absolutely phenomenal podcast here at TCCP today. Before we go, though, Stefan, do you have anything to just plug or promote? I know your social media channels, for example. Do you just want to tell people what they are?
Yeah, so Instagram, it would be Stefan Jones, that's 2F, Stefan Jones 105, that's my Instagram. Then Pace Lab Limited is the other Instagram for the Pace Lab company. PaceLabGlobal.com has just gone live a couple of weeks ago, so it sells programs, either tailored or generic programs. Again, baseball is picking them up massively, which is, I find it extraordinary that it is flying off a bit. And I'm talking proper pitchers, like not just major league pitchers are buying a $39.99 program. And then on Twitter, I don't do Twitter anymore. It just seems a whinging platform, to be honest. I don't do that a lot.
Well, fair enough, Stefan. And of course, from us two here at TCCP today, thank you very much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. It really has. You're always welcome back on, of course, here at the County Cricket Podcast. It's been a really, really good talk, but that does bring us to an end to what's been a phenomenal episode of the County Cricket Podcast. To all of the listeners out there, thank you very much for tuning in to today's episode. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.